Well, good evening. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line right now from the area of Washington, D.C., Mr. Larry Proud of Gun Owners of America. Larry, are you there?
Sure am. Good evening. Good to be with you.
Well, I appreciate your being up. It's 11 o'clock back there, and so I appreciate you staying up late to share with us your views on what's going on. You know, I was reading an article just a few minutes ago that the Air Force, on a regular basis, trains its pilots how to shoot down commercial airliners, American airliners, should they, of course, be hijacked by terrorists here. That doesn't make me feel very good when I understand that to date the administration has done everything they could to block the arming of airline pilots, even though the pilot overwhelmings of the public overwhelmingly supports the arming of airline pilots. Why the government has put every barrier in the way possible to stop pilots from getting being armed, and I think only about 200 of them have the ability to do that. Certainly they haven't been putting air marshals onto the planes. They just hired another 5,000 because of the public outcry. They haven't necessarily been checking the cargo that's put onto passenger planes for explosives, although they're going to start that now about 2 years after September 11th. It really makes you sort of feel very uneasy. You wonder if the government is totally incompetent or if they know something about this war against terrorism that we don't know. But why don't we talk a little bit about the airline pilots and the efforts to block their getting the ability to have a sidearm in the cockpit.
The pilots are extremely displeased with the administration's reluctance and the administration's determined efforts to keep the program from amounting to anything. And as you correctly observed, there are less than 200 pilots that have been armed during this whole time. Law has been on the books now, I guess, close to a year. And the TSA, the Transportation Safety Agency, a misnomer if there ever were one, has been very successful in only one thing, blocking progress. I talked to one of the more active pilots in lobbying for this today at a meeting downtown in Washington, and they have come to a position. Well, first of all, he observed that he'd gone in to seek the support early on in the very first stages of the effort to get support for the bill that eventually became law, and he took the measure into Congressman Hostetler's office, and the congressman is quite a constitutionalist, and when he looked at all the different things in there, he said, you know, the more provisions you put in there, the more ways you're going to make it so that the bureaucrats will keep this from happening. And he said, you know, the congressman was right. We've seen that you just don't give these guys any leeway. And so they have, I think, formed a consensus that, well, he put it this way. There are 35 states that now have concealed carry laws, that actually 36, that require the authorities to give a permit to carry a concealed firearm as long as the person isn't a crook, isn't a nut, basically. And so that, he said, ought to be the basis for pilots being able to pack a pistol in the cockpit. He said, for goodness sakes, we pass all kinds of psychological exams given by the FAA. They already do a background check on us. So really, any pilot that wants a gun, when you look at it that way, they've already qualified as far as a lot of the concealed carry laws in the country. And so they ought to be able to be walking around with a piece. And I said, well, the one other thing that I would like to see as part of your legislative initiative would be to make sure that the Transportation Safety Agency is unable to require you to carry the gun around in a lockbox. How would you like if you had a bodyguard, the Secret Service, say, protecting the president, and everywhere they go, they would have to have their gun in a lockbox? I mean, that's what they're talking to the pilots about, so that only when they're in the cockpit would they have the gun out. Well, that just makes it easier to steal the gun, frankly, if you do something like that. But the TSA isn't interested in effective self-defense. They're not interested in empowering the general populace with the ability to defend themselves, and in this case, the integrity of the plane. And as you mentioned earlier, Stan, they're talking about having, they're reporting, they're not talking about, they're reporting on the training that pilots, fighter pilots, are already getting shooting down passenger airliners.
Yeah, and this is so incredible. You, one of the other programs we did together, you were talking about how secure the doors are. Now, we're told, you know, we've done all these things. Of course, we're going to let the pilots be armed, which really isn't true. They're doing everything they can to stop it. But, well, we've got the doors secured now so that the hijackers won't get in. Would you like to tell that story?
Well, yes, back in June at Dulles Airport here in Washington, plane was a United Airlines plane, was on the ground, unattended except for a catering crew that was bringing the food service onto the plane, and because they were the only ones on, the cockpit door was locked. It was a reinforced door, and for whatever reason, I think just to see what would happen, the service crew said, let's take this service cart that the stewards use to take drinks around with their passengers. Let's just see what happens if we ram it into the door. Well, one shove, and that door went right off its hinges. And, of course, if they'd have been terrorists coming after the pilots, by the time you would have been able to respond to the noise, they'd have been in there. And there's about one, well, the door would probably hit some of the pilots' controls because the door's about 6 feet, and I don't think there's 6 feet from the doorway to where the pilots sit. So the first blow the pilots might feel would be this reinforced door slamming them on their wrist or something, assuming it fell straight in between the two pilots. Really a preposterous notion that the TSA has, that somehow all they need is a passive defense. It's kind of like the French before World War II thinking they could defend their country by preparing a defense called the Maginot Line, a static defense line that would have worked probably quite well in World War I because there were wholly different theories of warfare employed during that time. But the Blitzkrieg attack of the Nazis went right around the line. It didn't bother taking out the line. It just left those soldiers there. And they could shoot at the back of the Blitzkrieg as they were flying by, I guess, but that's about not all they could do.
Now, again, and one of the things that you mentioned in one of the other programs was the fact that they want to train these pilots in jiu-jitsu and karate and things like that. Now, you know, here the pilots are flying the plane, and they don't want them to have a gun. They want them to have, and I've seen some of those the cockpits are very, very small, but they want to teach them, you know, how to fight with their bare hands against these hijackers who may very well have knives and weapons of other sorts.
Yeah, I don't want them fighting with bare hands. I want them fighting with a 45, and I want it to be one of those rounds that breaks up and expands when it gets inside the target so that it has the ability to create the maximum amount of trauma possible so that there's the hope that the attacker will be losing consciousness and out of commission as quickly as possible. Because unlike the movies, unless somebody gets a really solid shot on his system, an attacker could keep on going, particularly if he's on drugs. And so you don't want to be playing mano a mano. You want to do everything you can to stop him literally dead in his tracks. I mentioned this to the pilots today that I found it somewhat Well, in fact, on some of the shows that I've done, when I mention that the training is being provided for pilots to do karate, people laugh. I mean, because if they've seen the inside of those cockpits, you know that that's a joke. They don't need to know karate. They need to know how to get on that gun into their hand and fire it probably from behind, you know, shooting at a target that's all over the back of them. The likelihood of them missing is pretty slim, really. So these guys are increasingly frustrated that, and he said, he was telling me about an air marshal that he'd seen just the other day, and it was a young woman in her mid-20s, early to mid-20s, and she had kind of a business suit attire on, a woman's suit, but it was a kind of a short-cut coat, and so very plainly visible was her Glock hanging about halfway down outside of the coat. So, duh, which one is the marshal in the plane?
Well, of course, you know, this is the other thing that really disturbs me. I mean, if we were really serious about protecting the American people from terrorism, we'd have one or two air marshals on every plane, as they do on the Jewish planes, all planes. But, of course, they have put very, very few marshals onto our planes, haven't they? Now, they've recently said, well, we're going to add another 5,000 marshals. But what's the truth about the air marshal program to protect the American people?
Well, they can't keep the marshals on. They tend to leave as quickly as they are being replaced, and they're only on a third of the flights coming out of Washington Reagan, which is the one airport where they really wanted to have 100% because of its proximity to the White House and the Capitol. That just isn't working, and yet the marshals themselves know what's going on. The pilots were telling me that, and this was just today, this is a long time now that all this has been going on, and the marshals say, you know, it'd really be better if you guys had the guns, and it's even better than if we're out here in the cabin. The best place to have the armed guy is up there in the cockpit. So the marshals are basically saying, we're second best. Not because we're not any good, but because we're out in the cabin, and once they figure out who we are, then that's not such a good plan. But up there in the cockpit, they have basically an area where there's nobody that can get behind them, right? I mean, they're sitting there with the instrument panel and the windshield surrounding them. So the bad guy can only come from one direction, whereas the marshal really doesn't know where the bad guy might come from. And if there were a team of bad guys, one of them could start, you know, stabbing a stewardess or something like that, and the marshal very likely would get up and try to put a stop to that. And as soon as he does that, the other bad guys get up, take the marshal out, and now they have the whole rear of the plane. So they understand that the most effective way to defend the plane is to put a gun in the hands of the guy who's driving the plane. You know, everybody but a bureaucrat in Washington can figure that out. Even the marshals, whose own job is to sit back there in the back of the bus, but the pilots had no argument that it's a pretty boring job for those guys because all they do is sit. They got to stay awake. Now, I don't know about you, but when I fly, I seldom remember even when the wheels come up. If I'm just sitting there, and that vibration running down the runway is just a wonderful way to go to sleep. And if I were a marshal, I just wonder how I'd be able to make it. I wonder if all of them do.
Well, I'm concerned because, of course, either there's callous disregard for the safety of the American people or the people in positions of power in Washington, D.C. know something that the rest of us don't. For instance, we hear a lot of talk about the terrorists having access to surface-to-air missiles, and we know that we'd given a number of these to the Afghans, who eventually became, of course, the so-called Al-Qaeda terrorists. So they have at least access to it theoretically, and there's been a lot of talk about how we ought to, you know, have defenses on every commercial airliner. Certainly the Israelis can afford to do it, but we say, oh, it would cost too much money, it would cost $10 billion to have these decoys on every commercial airliner, and yet we can put $150 billion into the war over in Iraq, but we can't defend civilian airliners here in the United States. And once again, I would simply point out that there's something terribly, terribly wrong with this picture, unless, of course, the people in Washington, D.C. know something about the real threat of terrorism that they're not telling us. Well, let's get into some of these other things, other than the fact that I think most of us would feel a lot safer with an armed pilot than knowing that there was an F-16 prepared to shoot down the plane we were on.
I think that is so obvious. You just wonder why that hasn't become an even bigger scandal. It really is scandalous that that's the alternative that they're comfortable with. It's not that it were a necessity. It's that that's what they have chosen. That's how they have actually directed affairs. It's the F-16 or nothing. Wow. But anyway, yeah, you're right. There's some other things we could be talking about.
All right, fine. Well, we've got Misha, I guess, is up in Yakima, Washington. Hi, Misha.
Yes, good evening.
Hi, did I pronounce your name right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, go right ahead.
Yeah, my question is, to really end this security problem, why don't they just build a separate compartment between the cabin of the pilots and where the passengers sit? So you'd have a completely separate cabin, and then you could have like two armed marshals and have two doors which are reinforced. Why don't the airlines do that?
Larry, what are your thoughts about what Misha's saying?
The idea has been discussed to put that compartment there, but it would require a redesign of the whole airplane, and it would be extremely expensive. Meanwhile, the cost of the 40 caliber Glock that they're going to be providing the pilots, I presume with the government discount, would probably be in the neighborhood of $350-$400. And frankly, I think no matter how many passive defenses that we have, whatever else we do, we need to have the pilots armed. And if we can reinforce the doors, that's fine. And if we can do anything else, that might be fine too. But to say that we ought not to have the pilots armed is to say that the one ultimate area of defense that we really want to make sure is operating, we're not going to take care of. Because if the bad guy gets control of the plane, that's the ball game.
Well, I'm all for arming the pilots, but why not just make another compartment, which is, four or five, 6 feet long?
It would be expensive.
They would have to redesign. If you look at the planes, you usually come in about two or three feet behind the pilot. Now, certain planes you might be able to do it, but it would be, I think, prohibitively expensive. But we'll just have to leave that up to the experts. I certainly agree with Larry. The important thing to do is to have the pilot armed. Anything else, Misha?
That's all.
Thanks so very much for calling. And our telephone number is, of course, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, Larry, in the past, we've talked about some of the new legislation, specifically the Patriot Act and the Patriot II Act, or the so-called Victory Act that they're talking about now, this massive expansion of federal police state power over the individual, because there's nothing in either the Patriot Act or any of the other legislation that specifies Islamic terrorism. And at least according to the definition of the Patriot Act, anybody in this listening audience could be considered potentially a terrorist if they object to the way things are being run in Washington, D.C. So what would you like to tell our listeners about the Patriot Act?
Well, one of the provisions in the Act says that the government can get its hands on any tangible evidence for any crime. So, like you were saying, it's not limited to terrorism. Any crime. And they can get that evidence that would be your cell phone, your computer records, your money transactions, your health records, your tax records, anything they want. All they have to do is go before the FISC, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or Security Court, one or the other. But it's a semi-secret court that operates here in Washington, and it denies almost none of the requests for warrants. So basically all an officer has to do is go through the proper procedures This is what I want. This is why I want it. And once he's done that, then the court has to give him a warrant. In other words, it's really not correct. It's very misleading to say, well, it's being checked by a court and has all the proper restraints. No, it would be just the opposite. It's really a remarkable thing when the court does not grant the warrant, and it's because apparently some officer was so sloppy that he couldn't even follow the regulations right. So they can get anything they want on anybody that they're interested in at all. It's about as difficult as going out to buy a ham sandwich.
And, of course, it really has nothing to do with terrorism. In fact, most of the cases that's been used, it would appear, it's been simply drug-related or other crimes. So what this was a massive expansion of government control under the name of fighting terrorism, but, of course, not necessarily fighting terrorism at all.
No. What we need to keep in mind is something that Gary Aldrich, in his book Thunder on the Left, pointed out, that the attack on September 11 did not occur because we did not have the Patriot Act in place. It occurred because the FBI made a big mistake. The FBI was incompetent. They got a request from the Minneapolis field office from the agent in charge up there, one of the senior agents, Colleen Rowley. And she put this request in that, hey, we've arrested this guy by the name of Zacharias Massaoui, and he had this real strange interest in flying an airplane but not taking off or landing, and that was one of the reasons why we thought we ought to look at him, and when we did, we got other evidence, and so we've arrested him as a terrorist suspect. This is all before September 11th. And they put in a request that they be able to search some of his stuff, and especially his computer. And the request was denied, and it was a mistake. And you know, nobody denies it was a mistake. They didn't need Patriot powers. They just needed to understand what their own procedures should have been. Well, on that computer was the entire blueprint for the September 11 attack. Had they looked at it, it's almost certain they would have been able to stop the attack from occurring. So they didn't need the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act was simply, as you just said, a way of enormously expanding federal police powers, which are unconstitutional to begin with, and it had nothing to do with the announced purpose. But this is the way the government typically proceeds, not just this government, but governments generally. I mean, you look at our history, every time we get into a conflict, a war of some kind of crisis, the government calls for extraordinary powers. That's just the pattern. And everybody gets scared, and everybody says, oh, yeah, man, anything but all this insecurity and lack of protection. Oh, yeah. Well, if we don't watch out, what we're going to need protecting from is our own government. Now, our founders gave us a constitution to protect us from our government. That's what the Constitution was all about, to limit the power of the government. And we have allowed ourselves to become persuaded that, oh, let's just give the government all the powers it needs because they're doing such a wonderful job, and all they care about is our best interest. Well, even if all they cared about were our best interest.
Hold up, for just a minute. We're going to have to bring our station back again. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Larry Pratt of the Gun Owners of America, and we're talking about the fact that the Constitution of the United States was established to protect us from the government. It was fear of governmental tyranny that was the basis of the writing of our Constitution and the limitations of power and the checks and balances, not only within the three branches of the federal government, but, of course, the separation of power between federal and state and local authority. And of course, we seem to have forgotten that. We have a terrorist attack, and immediately everybody says, let's give total totalitarian power to our federal government so we can maybe remain free. And I know that Larry shares my concern about that. You're really concerned about this massive increase in government power, aren't you?
It's the very thing that our founders were hoping to prevent with the ratification of our Constitution, that they would have provided a government that was, as Jefferson put it, tied down by the chains of the Constitution. And it seems to me that we, the citizens of the United States, have become the subjects and the suspects of the government all this power so they can look at all of us, because all of us are really potential criminals, and they want to tie us down with the chains of all their regulations and powers, and that's exactly the opposite of the way America's government is supposed to work.
You know, one of the things that really bothers me, Larry, is the fact that the Attorney General Ashcroft went out across America talking to the various communities and saying, look, there's nothing to worry about, the Patriot Act. If we didn't have that, why would we have so much more terrorism? And then, of course, he came up with the coup d'etat, coup de grace, and he said, look, everybody's so concerned about the government looking into library records and being able to subpoena library records. We want you to know we've declassified the information. There has not been one instance in the United States where the federal government, under the Patriot Act, has looked at library records. And we have an article out of the New York Times pointing out, well, that may very well be what Ashcroft says, but one librarian who received a subpoena for records and made that statement publicly, they're trying to indict her and put her in prison because she reveals they actually had tried to get the records from her, but there was a gag order. And if you are a librarian and you get one of these records, why, you face fines and imprisonment if you let anybody know. And then the Library Association sent out a questionnaire, and there were 16 librarians that had gotten these subpoenas. And yet the federal government would have the audacity to say, why, we've never used this. I mean, why would they lie to the American people? And if they would lie about that, what else would they lie about?
Well, that's a very disturbing question, and they're the reason that the question needs to be asked, because if they didn't lie about it, then Mr. Ashcroft is one of the worst managers in the history of the Republic, and he has no idea what the folks underneath him are doing. I suppose there's at least an argument you could make for that, but the argument's not too much help for the administration, because it would mean that you've got to point to all the Clinton appointees that are still carried over by the Bush administration, and these Clintonistas certainly don't have the interest of freedom in their decision making, and the administration has been very deficient in this area, because they've said, well, these people are professionals, and they're not political, they're just doing a good job professionally. Well, that's not the way it's supposed to be run. You know, we elected a president, so he would take command of that government, control it, and run it the way he said he was going to run it during the election. Well, it's not working out that way. So either Ashcroft is just plain out fibbing, or it's more of the same, where they just aren't paying attention to who's in the chicken coop.
Well, you know, what really bothers me is when the Democrats get in, they fire all the Republicans. When the Republicans get in, they keep all the Democrats, or an awful lot of them. And,
yeah.
And this should cause all of us a lot of concern and make us really wonder, what's this all about? What's really going on behind the scenes?
Well, this happened under Reagan. Reagan had the same failing. He would appoint people based on personal friendship rather than really vetting them to find out, hey, do you think the way I do?
All right, fine. Well, we're going to have to take a break here, and when we get back, of course, we'll invite our callers from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But the first thing we're going to do when we get back is tell you how you can get in touch with Larry Pratt and Gun Owners of America. It's one of the few organizations in this country that I can recommend without hesitation. I've known the original organizer of this for 40 years, Senator H.L. Richardson, and you can depend upon the information they put out. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you are out there in the listening audience and you agree with us that they really do have problems in America, and this information needs to be gotten out, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to the possibility of joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And it's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and they can tell you a little bit about what it means to become a member of the Radio Liberty family. Of course, if you would like to have one of our newsletters, and people who join the Radio Liberty family get our newsletter and our four best tapes of the month every month, but if you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, we'd be glad to get that for you. And you can just call that same number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-544-8927. We'll be glad to get that off to you. And then, of course, we hope many of our listeners will go to our website, which is www.radioliberty.com. Now, you can pull down our newsletters there going back many years, back to 1998, 1999. And we invite you to not only pull them down, but to keep them, to bind them, to copy them, to get them into other people's hands. And we deal with the difference between a republic and a democracy, and why did our founding fathers give us a republic, and why is the fact that we have become a democracy the antithesis of what was originally intended. And then, of course, on Radio Liberty, you can listen to our archive programs, and all of the Radio Liberty programs are archived, and then there's several other networks we do programs on, and you can link to those networks as well, and hear our early morning program at 7 o'clock every morning, or you can hear our early afternoon program on the Genesis Network. If you're interested, we're there 5 hours a day. As we reach out across America, trying to make people understand the true nature of the battle in which we're engaged, because if the truth of the matter be known, we're involved in a spiritual battle, which is being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, economic, educational battlefield, and the average person doesn't even know the battle is going on. But believe me, one day, very, very soon, they will, because we are moving into very, very difficult times here in America, as the job foundation of our nation, our industrial capacity, is gradually being intentionally transferred out of America, as the value of our currency is gradually being eroded away, as a planned program of impoverishing the middle class. But our job is to reach as many people as we can, and that, of course, is our obligation to them and to God. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and first of all, our guest is Larry Pratt. And Larry, how can people get in touch with you and Gun Owners of America?
We have a website that is full of information and ways to join Gun Owners of America, also to get on our free email list, which is an alert that goes out usually just once a week, but it's designed to help those who want information and want to do something with it. We try to make it easy with an email to go ahead and communicate with members of Congress so they know what their voters want or don't want. You can find all this at gunowners.org, one word, plural, gunowners.org. And then if you can't do that, why, please call us toll-free. That's 888-88-6-GUNS. That's 888-886-GUNS, G-U-N-S.
And I think one of the real advantages of Gun Owners of America is that they certainly are focused on the gun issue, but they do cover other issues like the Patriot Act. And, of course, they have a treatise on the Patriot Act. And then, of course, they're concerned about what's happening as far as their educational system and the deliberate dumbing down of our children. And what are these academies that they're setting up all across America now under this No Child Left Behind program?
Well, it's in a proposal that the administration backs. It's a piece of legislation that's passed the Senate unanimously, well, 98-0, and it's now being considered in the House. It's a bill there put in by Representative Roger Wicker, conservative Republican of Mississippi, and it would establish these academies. It doesn't really give you any details about what would be taught, who would do it. But the mechanism is known to be that of throwing lots of money at socialist professors in universities around the country. These professors would then set up the programs for the academy of a particular state, or maybe in a big state for part of a state. And those academies would then train the teachers how to teach, if you will, the new history, the new civics. The federal government, under No Child Left Behind and other legislation earlier that was enacted under Bill Clinton, has managed to set up national standards for history and civics. And the Department of Education has said, if your test scores for the students in your school aren't good enough, we're going to cut your money off that we send you from Washington, that you sent us already to begin with, and that subsidy that you're getting from the Department of Education will be cut. Well, the curriculum standards that they have developed are easy to see what they're doing. They're in a so-called guideline called We the People. That was used to redesign the test to reflect the guideline. And there's a textbook by the same name, We the People. And in this textbook, for instance, the Second Amendment, which naturally we gun owners of America are particularly interested in, is handled in an extremely subtle and an extremely deleterious fashion. First, they do actually quote Patrick Henry and James Madison on the individual right to keep and bear arms. Immediately, they start asking questions about, well, how would you defend that today? You know, that was then, this is now. They start talking about the responsibilities of a global citizen. And then when we get to the rights that are important today, there's no mention at all of the Second Amendment. This is in the latter part of the book. They never discuss the Tenth Amendment, and the student is left with the idea that there's really no adequate basis for defending the Second Amendment as an individual right to keep and bear arms in our day. I was talking to some interns not long ago, and one of the interns afterwards said, you know, in my school we use this book, and by the time the teacher was finished with the questions that she was asking, it was very clear that we were supposed to believe that the Second Amendment was just the collective right of the states and it had nothing to do with individuals. Well, you know, there's so many ways you could know that that's not true. One of them is that during the time of the discussion and the debate over the Bill of Rights, there were three states that actually put up some sort of language that would have guaranteed a state's right to have a militia. Well, if you'll notice, that never made it into the Constitution. In fact, what they were doing, they had that and they had some other amendments that they were proposing that would have dealt with the powers of government. But if you look at the preamble of the Bill of Rights, you realize that the Bill of Rights does one thing only. It protects rights of individuals and has nothing to do with powers of government. And so that's just one of many ways you can know for sure that the founders decided, nope, in the Bill of Rights, we're talking about individual rights. That's what it's all about.
And I think really what people have to understand, it was a restrictive covenant. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be abridged. And the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, to limit the power of government over the lives of the people. And then the Tenth Amendment, saying all power not specifically here given to Congress or reserved to it by the states, is to be reserved to the states or people. Or the people, and it is to restrict the power of the federal government. That's what it was about, but they never teach that anymore. They of course want to do away with that. They want us to believe we're a democracy and whatever our elected officials want to do, why they can do, but the problem is We have some of the best elected officials that money can buy that are answerable not to the people who elected them, but to the people who bought and sold them. And that's the real danger of this form of government. That's why they created a republic where what the elected officials could do was limited. Today, they can do whatever they want to, and we're on the path to a totalitarian state.
This bill looked like, 98-0 in the Senate. Whew, this thing's going to pass like a lightning bolt. Well, it did go through the Senate easily, although the Senate, frankly, does lots of bad things easily. But in the House, it's been a different story. And Gun Owners of America has weighed in and has asked its members to send email to the House. And actually, this week, we asked to have them sent to the White House. There was a meeting of some Republican representatives earlier this week. And Senator Lamar Alexander came to lobby for the House bill. It was his bill that had passed in the Senate. Lamar Alexander was Secretary of Education under George I, and he's long time been pushing some very bad educational theories that essentially, I guess you could sum up, it may not be that familiar a concept, but at least the educationists use the term operant conditioning. In other words, whenever a student gets a stimulus, then he responds appropriately, and he doesn't respond until he gets a stimulus. So he becomes very passive. And that's what Alexander's been promoting across his career. Well, he came to try to get some skeptical Republican conservatives to either get on the bill or to not get off the bill, because there's been a lot of talk once Gun Owners of America started bombarding these folks with their own voters, their own constituents, that the bill might be in a little bit of trouble. And he mentioned to this one congressman that he ought to get on, and the congressman said, I had 50 gun owners email me that I better not get on that bill, and he said, until they email me again telling me I ought to get on the bill, I don't think I'm going to be able to get on the bill, Mr. Senator. And then Alexander went on to make his case as to why it was such a great bill, and they're going to throw all these millions of dollars into these academies and blah, blah, blah. And the more they heard, the more their eyes got wide, and when he was finished, four of them said, I'm off the bill.
Well, I think this is so important for our listeners to understand that this is what Gun Owners of America does. This is what Larry Pratt does. They're back there in Washington, D.C., and, of course, they're looking at certainly gun issues, but they're looking at these other issues. And, of course, the academy, the purpose of the academy is to train the teachers, are going to train the children, and, of course, they're going to utilize this to undermine the belief in our society, to change the attitudes, values, and beliefs of the children, and that is the last thing we want. Let's go right now to John from Post Falls, Idaho. Hi, John. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Thinking about airline safety, gentlemen, I suspect there's a lot more going on than just bureaucratic ineptitude, but rather a calculated psychology to get people used to surrendering their personal protection to the nanny state. And I hope I'm not alone in this view, but just thinking about the way George Washington did about firearms, I look at an airline cabin as a microcosm of society at large. And I think not only should every air crew be armed, but along with their consent and knowledge, many of the passengers that are properly qualified should be free to carry modest personal defense, and I define that as any firearm or edged weapon which by itself doesn't threaten the integrity of the aircraft. And I think if you had that, you'd eliminate most of the costly harassment of passengers, and you'd be free to focus the energies of the screeners more on explosives. And most of all, it would create uncertainty in the minds of the aggressors so as to make air piracy all but impossible. What do you guys think?
Well, let's ask Larry Pratt. Of course, what John is suggesting is that people who have a right to carry permit be allowed to take a gun on a plane.
Well,
do you think that that's legitimate?
Well, you've got to ask. If there had been somebody, a good guy, who just, let's say he forgot that he had his .45 in his carry-on and somehow it got through, which actually has happened in some of the airports. And let's assume that he was on one of those four flights on September 11. Would anybody on that flight have minded if he'd pulled out his piece and started popping away at terrorists? I don't think so.
I think they would have been tremendously grateful.
I think that it would have. And I'll tell you, we had an opportunity to talk to a gentleman named Van Vake. He was in he was a South African, and he was in a church in Cape Town one evening when four terrorists with automatic rifles came in, and they started just shooting indiscriminately at the population there, and he had a pistol. And he stood up, and he shot one of those, and they all ran, and he saved dozens of lives because he had a weapon with him. Nobody ever talks about all the lives that are saved because somebody has a weapon, because there is an agenda. They want to disarm the public and make them totally helpless against the all-powerful state. Anything else, John?
Well, yeah, one of your other callers referenced a partitioning aircraft, and that's not only not feasibly economically, but we need to consider the possible scenario where you have infiltration of radical Islam in the cockpit itself, and I think there's probably an example of that. That Egypt Air flight you recall over, I think it was Newfoundland, that was dived into the ocean, and that was one of the trained pilots. And if you had the possibility of air marshals actually re-infiltrating the cockpit, then it might eliminate that scenario. And unfortunately, because of the squeamishness about guns in our society, I'm afraid I'm going to boycott airlines for the rest of my life. I don't expect to ever fly again unless it's on general aviation or something, because I will not go unarmed.
All right. Go. Thank you so much for calling, John.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, of course.
And by the way, John, I'm afraid, is speaking, say, on behalf of the airline industry, it's not atypical. There are people that have decided that it's either too risky or just too much of a hassle. The privacy invasion specialists that they've set up, called the Transportation Safety Agency Inspectors, frankly, most of that wouldn't be needed, as John was implying. They could focus on inspecting for explosives, and the rest of this fetish they have for disarming 93-year-old grandmothers of their nail clippers or their box cutter or something like that, all that would vanish once the pilots are armed. Just arming the pilots alone would cut out a whole lot of this nonsense that, frankly, is extremely aggravating. And I see people, if people, unlike myself, who really have to fly because it's the only way I can keep up with the schedule that I have, but a lot of people don't travel that much, and when they do, it's more for to go see Aunt Matilda, and they could drive, and they're driving. Unless she lives 5,000 miles away, they're driving. They heck with these guys.
And I think that this is one reason why the airlines are really having so much trouble financially.
Yes,
is that an awful lot of people, you know, they know that those F-16s are out there ready to, and they're actually practicing several times a week shooting down civilian airliners. And then, of course, they know, if they listen to our programs, of course, they get your material, that the government's doing everything they can to block the arming of airline pilots. And they know that there really aren't marshals on very many of the planes, and that they're really not doing anything to protect the people, and they're really not trying to seal the borders and keep the terrorists out. So I can understand why people would have a very, very uneasy feeling about flying. But as you, I have to fly just not infrequently because of my schedule. So, well, what can our listeners out there do, perhaps to help get the airline pilots armed, to get adequate marshals on the planes, and, of course, to let the people in Congress know that we're very unhappy with the administration's position as far as protecting the American people?
Well, the whole operational methodology of Gun Owners of America is oriented to carrying out what Senator Everett Dirksen used to be so fond of saying, that when I feel the heat, I see the light. And by the grace of God, we've been able to grow to the size of about 300,000 members now.
How many members?
About 300,000.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So that when something comes up, we're able to have enough focus of enough constituents, of individual members of Congress, senators, representatives, that they really do start to feel the heat. The reason the attack on the gun shows was broken off was precisely because the members of Gun Owners of America would not take more gun control for an answer. And even though the NRA had become fearful that the bill might pass, and it was a bad bill, and therefore they decided to settle for a less onerous bill, a watered-down bill, we just said, no deal. We don't want any more gun control, even if it's watered down. And our members said, that's right. And they just kept hammering away. It was a battle that lasted from 1998 through 2000. And we finally were able to prevail. And it was heat. It wasn't the articulate arguments that I might have been making or someone on the staff might have been making up on the Hill. It was the postcards and the mail and the email that were coming from the constituents, our members, their voters, that got the message across. At one point in the struggle, the Senate had quickly passed after Columbine in 1999 their very dangerous version of the attack on the gun shows. And in the House, as this battle rocked along and our members were putting the heat on, the Republican leadership was hearing from the rank-and-file representatives across the Hill from the House, whatever you want us to do on the gun issue, just don't make gun owners of America mad at us. And that's why the measure got killed, because enough people acted with enough determination at the right time, on the right target, with the right message. So it's organization. It doesn't require millions and millions. It just requires enough people to convince them that, you know, my next reelection may not be a whole lot of fun. I think maybe I'd better get a lower profile on this issue. And that's how it was done.
Well, you know, one of the things is that the people in Washington, D.C. really don't want their constituents to know how they vote. In fact, some of them don't even give a lot of thought to some of the bills. They just vote yay or nay the way that the party leaders tell them. But if they know that their constituents are going to know how they vote and they're concerned about it and they're going to be angry with them if they vote the wrong way, why, of course, they may very well vote the right way. And this is really why I think what you do is so vitally important, Larry, and why I recommend that our listeners out there call either 1-888-886-GUNS. That's 1-888-886-GUNS. Or the website again?
Is gunowners.org.
Gunowners.org. That's pretty easy.
That's all you have to type in your browser, right. Actually, and it'll get right there.
And find out what they're doing. And we act in a coordinated manner. If the people of America acting in a coordinated manner, it's much more than you're just sending an email. You know that hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands are going to be sent from all across America. So this is why Larry's here tonight, so you'll know where to go to get the information on what the most important issues facing us are today. And really, I commend you and your staff there for really being on top of so much of what's going on, Larry.
Well, we're very blessed that we have members who are so loyal, who not only cooperate with us in the fight by putting the heat on, but have been generous enough to keep the lights on, and that combination has been very gratifying, because it's given us the opportunity, the privilege, really, to be in this position. And we're just very grateful that we've been here at a time like this, because we've seen some fights come up that really look pretty hopeless. But it's amazing what happens if you are willing to fight and just say, you know, end of compromises, we're not making any concessions. If you beat us, you beat us, but we're going to make it really unpleasant. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's what it was with Senator Hatch. Senator Hatch had been the chief sponsor of the attack on the gun shows, a conservative Republican from Utah. And we went after him in 2000 because he still had it within his power to conceivably push this thing through in 2000. And he was up for re-election. He had to go through a convention. And that was a venue we could afford to operate in. It was only about 4,000 people that would go to the convention. Well, he beat us. We narrowly missed forcing him into a primary. But even at that, it cost him $600,000. And when he went back to Washington, just less than a week after his victory in the convention, the rest of the Republican leadership was asking him to, okay, now that you've been reelected, and course, he had been virtually reelected because of the victory in the convention in that very Republican state. Come on, Orrin, let's get your gun control bill out and get it passed and get that off the agenda. And he looked at them and he said, you don't know how politically ill-advised that would be. And he killed his own bill, even though the leaders thought it was going to be such a good idea. He had learned, even before Al Gore did later that election year, gun control kills politicians.
Well, I certainly hope it's something that we can utilize here in California in the next few days.
Well, hopefully Mr. McClintock is going to benefit from the dissolving reputation of the front runner, and McClintock is just a straight arrow, and he's been extremely effective and faithful on the Second Amendment issues, as well as every other kind of limited government issue. So hopefully he may still pull it out.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see. It's going to be an exciting 3 or 4 days, but fortunately we have about four or five stations that are going to be carrying our programs over the weekend, and well, we won't tell you who we're backing, but I think that you know. Under any circumstances, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners this evening, Larry?
We've been encouraged that we've been able to see what can be done when people are organized and when they're willing to confront the political system with their views and reminding the politicians that they have a constitutional obligation. They took an oath of office, and that's, I think that gives us the moral standing to have the confidence to be able to go and stand before these politicians. And then when we've seen some of these victories, it's encouraging to think that, you know, if we keep doing this and if we can keep growing a little bit, we may just be able to start pushing them back. And instead of always being on the defense, which is primarily where we've been heretofore, but in the case of the pilots, that's actually, however limited it might be, that's offensive. We're retaking lost ground. When we get a state to sign on as a shall issue concealed carry state, got to give you a permit if you're not a crook or a nut, no more discretion, no more deciding whether you have a need to carry a gun. Well, anybody has a need to carry a gun. They need to protect their lives. That's all the need you need. And those laws have been marching across the country. There's now 36 states, including two, Vermont and Alaska, where you don't even need a permit. So we shouldn't get tired of doing good. We shouldn't get discouraged that it hasn't been easy. That's all part of the fall of man, I guess, is that none of this is going to be easy. It's going to be a constant battle, but it doesn't mean that we can't win. But we've got to really be willing to exert ourselves and stay in the fight. And if folks want to join gun owners, we'll certainly try to make it so they can stay in this fight.
God bless you. Thanks for everything you do, Larry. And we'll be talking to you in the not-too-distant future.
Appreciate it, Stan. Thanks so much.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed the program with Larry Pratt. He's a fine gentleman, and the Gun Owners is a good organization. I don't hesitate at all to recommend it to you. They're straight as an arrow. Well, this is the time we ask our listeners to remember that we're involved in a spiritual battle. Pray for America. Pray for revival in America, because if the American people don't turn back to God, God will never again bless this nation. And lastly, of course, we ask you to remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday, when we'll be back with you once again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening. Dr. Stan here once again at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because we have with us on the line, Paul, and is Lorraine there as well?
Lorraine is right here if you want her on the show too.
Well, you and she are going to have to decide what we'll do. Paul and Lorraine Walter, we've had on many, many times before, and they've republished a book called The Coming Battle. And, of course, it was a book written, what was it, about 1898?
1899 when it was published.
1899, but written in 1898, published in 1899. And of course, well, why don't you give our listeners the background of the book in case they're not acquainted with it? Because when you read this book written over 100 years ago, you realized the importance of this, and you actually have brought the book back and republished it.
Well, we republished it, I would say, about 7 or 8 years ago. I got a hold of a copy, and I couldn't believe what I was reading. It contained the complete blueprint for destruction of America, how the international bankers partnering with government and the corporate interests, how the tree of the corporations, the banking money power, and people in government partnering, how to create a framework to exploit the American workers. And that's really what the Coming Battle book is about. And Mr. Walbert warned us that if we allow these corporations to get out of control, that eventually we'll go into basically a corporate police state. And he says you will wake up one day on a continent that your founding fathers conquered homeless. And I'll tell you something, I see that happening exactly today. And I think the coming battle, when, you know, the battle is about to come. And I really believe that because Mr. Walbert saw this coming and the ugly head of this corporate police that is just beginning to rear its head right now. And anyway, so the book is very prophetic as well.
Well, you know, I was reading something just this last day or two in the Wall Street Journal. Well, they have a new program for the corporations. And a lot of the corporations have been going overseas. And, of course, they've accumulated large sums of money there, which they don't have any pay any taxes on. So they're going to give them the opportunity to bring up to $400 billion, that is B, billion dollars, $400 billion in money back into the United States without paying any taxes. In other words, they don't have to pay any taxes, income taxes, on the money they've made overseas. Anything over $400 billion, of course, they'll have to pay taxes on. And then after that, if they repatriate money here from overseas, why, they will pay about 5.5% on it. Now, you and I will pay, 15-20% on our income, but the corporations make their money overseas will only pay a little 5.5%, but they, the first $400 billion they bring back will not be taxed. Now, if you stop and think about what I'm saying, it seems like they have one set of rules for the corporations, another for the individual.
Well, you know, I don't really hold the corporations responsible for this. I hold our government officials responsible for this because they allowed this. They passed laws that would actually bring this into being. So they create conditions in this country to where corporations are give them an opportunity to move to Mexico, India, China, any place where there is slave labor, you know, where people work for 10 cents a dollar and they make their money there cheaply, and then turn around and bring the goods here and sell it for high profit. So I blamed our government for creating this, and NAFTA and GATT, that they passed, when they passed this into law, because that gave an opportunity to do this.
Well, I did a fascinating interview this morning with an Ian Vasquez from the Cato Institute, and he was talking about the overseas private Investment Corporation, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, a government agency that loans money to corporations that want to invest overseas but don't want to have to pay large or high interest rates because the investments are in countries that where the property may be expropriated. But you don't have to worry. They also give them insurance in case their property, their investment is expropriated. So what are the corporations? Why, they're Citibank and Shell Oil and Exxon and, you know, just little tiny corporations like that. And of course, where are they investing? Venezuela, they're investing in Russia. And we're going to have Ian on in one of our other programs so we can get more details on this. But here, the largest corporations in the United States are being subsidized by the American taxpayers and guaranteed that if their investments are seized, why, of course, Mr. and Mrs. Sucker will actually pay Citibank. Now, this is, for people who don't know, Citibank is one of the two largest banks in the entire world. And yet, of course, it has to be subsidized. And that's simply part of this. They have the Export-Import Bank, and they have other government corporations that have been subsidizing our industries to move overseas into China and taking American jobs with it. And it just doesn't make any sense logically, unless, of course, these people are intentionally going to impoverish the middle class of America.
That's what it's all about. You know, the coming battle talks about how in the middle 1800s, or I would say, what about, Lori, would you say about 73 or so after the President Grant's presidency, how they imported cheap foreign labor into the United States to take away American jobs. They imported Hungarians and Czechoslovakians and from Poland, from all over the world. They brought them in here to work in the textile industries in New York and back in the East Coast to take away, you know, American jobs, because Americans are used to a fair wage in those days. So they brought in cheap labor to drive the American wages down, which created countless labor riots. And Mr. Walbert documents how many labor riots and stuff it created in this country back in the late 1800s. That, you know, I didn't know until I read The Coming Battle. So what I call this NAFTA and GATT in reverse, because what we have today is they export our industry to the cheap foreign labor. And back in the Walbert days when he wrote The Coming Battle book, they were importing cheap labor into the Americas. So instead of exporting businesses to them, they brought them to our businesses. So it's basically the same thing in reverse. So there's nothing new under the sun. And the reason The Coming Battle book is so important, because it takes the reader back to the foundation of this country through the eyes of a man that was born before the Civil War, and they can see how the road was paved to destruction, so to speak, from 1776 to 1899. And, of course, we know the history from 1899 on.
Well, now, of course, did he talk at all about the Rockefellers?
Oh, yeah. Talks about the Rockefellers. He doesn't?
No, I'm just saying, I think for our listeners have to understand that the Rockefeller fortune was created during those years by ruthless exploitation and by thuggery and by either beating up people or, you know, wouldn't go along with them or eliminating the competition. And, of course, if you went along with them, fine. If you didn't, they would destroy you.
Well, he talks about J.P. Morgan.
Sure.
And the Rothschilds.
And the Rothschilds, and they were all involved in this ruthless exploitation of society.
And it talks about the different banks that were on the East Coast that became the Federal Reserve System, and I believe Chase is one of them. We just, Chase Manhattan today, and it was called something else. Hanover, it names all the banks in the book.
And, of course, they've continued on. Of course, there was Chase, and then they joined Chase Manhattan. And now I think that whether it's, of course, David Rockefeller was the president of that for a long period of time. And these are still some of the largest banks in the world today.
Yeah, he talks about it. Here, I'm looking at the page. It's page on 247. It says Chase National Bank, Citibank. It talks about all of them. They're all listed in here that they were part of the making of the Federal Reserve System.
And, of course, the Federal Reserve System was not in vogue in 1899, but they were already planning on creating this privately owned central bank and sell it to the American people under the name of the Federal Reserve. So the American people would honestly believe this was an agency of our federal government rather than representing the bankers, which at time before exploited the American people by creating run-ups and everybody takes out loans and then collapsing the economy and everybody loses their property.
The most important thing that people have to realize about the book, The Coming Battle, is that it gives the early history of the international bankers and the families who helped form the Federal Reserve in 1913. On page 61, it will tell the reader that the reason why they wanted this central banking system is so that they could ruin our economy. And they knew it had to be done through the monetary system. And the London Times in 1865 is listed on that page, and it talks about how if they don't stop America from becoming so prosperous that it will get rid of every monarchy on this globe. And that's why they wanted this central banking system, so that they could destroy America through our monetary system, and that's exactly what the Federal Reserve is doing.
And, of course, the thing is that right now they're massively expanding the amount of money that's out there with absolutely nothing behind it. They're increasing the monetary supply, and this is the M1, M2, M3, by about $1.5 to $2 trillion a year. And so we're up around $43 trillion that is owned. That's the actual amount of at least paper money that's out there, or requirements for paper money. There's only about maybe $700 billion of money in circulation, and yet you've got all these other monetary increments. And, of course, if they ever had to be cash into cash, there isn't any cash to put it into.
Right. What the people, your listeners, probably don't understand, hopefully they do, is that this national debt, back in President Grant's time, he signed a bill into law, the Act to Strengthen Public Credit, in 1869. When he signed that bill, it pledged the American people, you and I and our children and grandchildren, as collateral for the repayment of all government debt. So when our president says they're going to give Iraq so many billions of dollars to rebuild, and they're going to give Mexico so many dollars so that they can bring their level of standard of living up to what ours is, and other foreign countries, the American people do not realize that we are the ones left holding the bag. We are the collateral, and every asset that we own, our homes, our land, our cars, boats, everything, we are, I would say,
indentured slaves
to the international bankers.
And, of course, people don't really understand how this all fits together, but it's a long-range plan, and I think it's coming to its culmination very, very soon. There was an article, and you can find this on David Morgan's homepage, and I checked it out, and, of course, it's referring to an article on the International Monetary Fund, which has stated that the American economy could collapse at any moment, and talking about our financial system because of our massive, massive federal deficits, because of our massive international deficits, and, of course, because our industrial base has shrunk so much and will continue shrinking until eventually, of course, this whole house of cards comes tumbling down, and that's exactly what they intend. But if they tell the American people that, they'd be furious. But as long as things are good, as long as somebody else losing their job, most people aren't going to be concerned.
Well, you know, on page 339, Mr. Walbert says, quote, if any citizen of the United States doubts that there is a giant international gold and bond trust seeking to bind the world to its golden chariot, let him read this notorious contract and be convinced of this error. In other words, he's saying how J.P. Morgan and all these people here, and it's a whole thing is documented in the book, how they plan to destroy this country.
Well, how do they plan to destroy it specifically, Paul?
Well, through the monetary system, through the debt system. By, in other words, pig iron Kelly, see, let me go back a little bit. Andrew Jackson knew the dangers of these banks. He was, one of our best presidents, and he believed that the generation who incurred the debt is the generation that should pay the debt off, so you don't pass it on to your, so you don't indenture the futurity of our futurity, or how he says it, in our country. In other words, your children and your children's children. Well, when he died and he left the presidency, they passed a law to roll the debt over from generation to generation. In other words, to them, it didn't make any sense for you to pay the debt off. They wanted every American, every human being actually on this planet to be indentured slave. So what they did is they did away with this, where they can keep rolling the debt over, rolling the debt over, rolling the debt over, what you're witnessing today. And the debt is so huge now that, I mean, it's there's no way this could be paid off. It's impossible. It's like, it's a fool's man's dream that you think you can do something like that. It cannot be accomplished. Well, so, and they're building on it and building on it. For example, they send $87 billion to prop up Iraq, and then there are troops who go in a hospital for getting injured in Iraq have to pay their own food in the hospital. Thank God that this was overturned a few weeks ago, but it's incredible that here we're sending $87 billion to Iraq, and yet our own troops have to pay their own airfare home and pay their own hospital bill in our own hospital when they, in hospital when they get injured in Iraq.
Well, I think they pay for the food. They don't pay for their medical care.
No, just for the food. But that was overturned, by the way.
But, of course, the other thing is they're doing everything they can to cut back on the financial compensation for the veterans and cutting back on medical care for our veterans who were promised, you know, if they would spend 20 or 30 years in the military, they would get free medical care for the rest of their life. And now they're saying, sorry, Charlie, you never should have believed us. And, of course, if they'll betray our veterans, why do they think they won't betray the rest of the American people? There is a plan to transfer American jobs out of this country, which is what NAFTA and the World Trade Organization are all about. And, of course, as time goes by, we're going to see more and more ramifications from this. The whole world is overburdened with debt, and, of course, the only way to do away with that debt is simply massively to shrink the economy and, of course, to get rid of the debt that way. And when you do that, it's going to be a very difficult time for some years until all that debt can be done away with and the price of goods comes back to something rational. Sir John Templeton, one of the smartest men in the world, who headed for many years the Templeton Fund, made a statement recently that he didn't think people ought to be buying a house. They ought to wait until houses were down and cost about one-tenth of what they do now, and that would be a good time to buy a house. Ladies and gentlemen, he believes there's a real estate bubble that's going to pop, and when it does, heaven help us all.
Yeah, but you know what? When the house, I'm confused about one thing. When the houses go down, so will your currency.
Absolutely.
Well, so if you got, let's say, a couple hundred thousand in the bank, your couple hundred thousand will be worthless, so you still won't be able to buy a house. Unless you have gold and silver, I believe.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see how this whole thing works out. Certainly, what the international financiers have done, the people who control the central banks, is they tell us that gold is of no value, it doesn't go up in value, and yet they've accumulated all this. Why would they accumulate all that gold if it's of no value?
Exactly.
Very simply because if they hold the gold and they hold the silver, then what can we trade and exchange among ourselves? The only thing we can trade and exchange is worthless paper money that they print, but we have to have a means of exchange to maintain a civilized society.
You know, Mr. Wolbert documents, Stan, how back in the 1800s, they raided the treasury and replaced all our gold and silver in your U.S. treasury and shipped it all to Europe and replaced it with their own paper debt money.
Also, too, we have to keep in mind that the Act to Strengthen Public Credit, where we owe the international bankers the national debt, they do not want it paid back in their debt notes. They want it paid back in gold and silver only. If we don't have it, then we're indentured. Plain and simple.
Well, we have real problems as a country. But the average individual is totally unaware of this fact. They honestly think that the Federal Reserve System has something to do with the federal government. And you tell people that it is a privately owned central bank, owned by the banks, And they'll sort of look at you and their eyes will glass over, and that can't be true because, well, everybody knows this is a branch of the federal government. And yet all of the central banks of the world are privately owned central banks. They work in concert through the International Bank of Settlement in Switzerland. They, of course, work together to control the governments of this world, to inflate the economy, to contract the economy, and, of course, whenever they do contract the economy, they impoverish the people, because people have bought a house and they've got payments to make, no longer can make those payments, they lose the house, and, of course, the bankers get it at a very, very low cost.
You know, Stan, I'm confused about one thing. How can politicians who are born here in our country, who are Americans, pass laws that would screw American people that worked all their lives, that would lose everything, like create NAFTA and GATT to make opportunities to where businesses would ship their factories to China and Mexico? How could they do that to their own people? I can't comprehend this.
Well, I think you have to understand that some of them are not very smart. First of all, we were told that NAFTA was going to give us all of these new jobs. I mean, we had certainly a positive balance of payment with Mexico and Canada at the time, but, you know, once we open up the borders, why, of course, then we would have all those people in Mexico we could sell our products to, and we would have, another 50, 70, 80 million people buying our products right and left, and it was going to create all these new jobs and all this prosperity in the United States. And I think that some of our congressmen honestly believed the lie. Instead of increasing our jobs, why, it took our jobs away. Instead of course, giving us a positive balance of payments situation, why, we went into a negative balance of payment situation with both Canada and Mexico. And then, of course, they did the same thing with the World Trade Organization. What people don't understand is that the World Trade Organization treaty was 28,000 pages. Now, how many people do you think are going to read a 28,000-page, a document? And there was just no way they could. I mean, it contained such things as every child born in the United States would have to have a Social Security number. What does that have to do with the World Trade? Absolutely nothing. But, of course, they put a lot of things in there that were aimed at changing our way of life and changing the structure of society. And, of course, there was tremendous pressure put on by the administration, both the Republican and Democratic administration, to pass this legislation, because the leaders of both political parties' loyalty is not to the United States, but to this internationalist dream. And then, of course, the congressmen were told if they didn't go along with this, they wouldn't get any support for the next election. And I know people who actually voted for NAFTA because they thought this is the only way they're going to get reelected. I know there was a congressman in Northern California who actually lost his election because he lost the support of his constituents because he had lied to them. He told them he wouldn't vote for NAFTA, and then, of course, when he got to Washington, they said, you either vote for NAFTA or you're not going to get elected, and he voted for NAFTA, and he didn't get reelected because the people, his district, no longer trust him. His name was Baker.
Well, so in other words, what you're telling me is the politicians, they don't have a set of principles that they could adhere to, that to them, they're subject to the strongest influence of whoever puts the most pressure on, and that's the way they bend.
Absolutely. In fact, as somebody once said, most politicians aren't dedicated to the right, or they're not dedicated to the left. They're dedicated to staying in Washington, D.C., and they'll do whatever they have to stay there. That's what it's really all about.
You know, if I was a congressman or a senator, I would do what's right. And if people said to me, well, listen, you go along with us, or we're not going to support your next election, I said, take your next election and stick it, it doesn't matter to me. I'm going to do what's right anyway, and if I don't get elected again, that's fine.
Well, I think that's the way it should be, and that's the way that there are few people who will take that position, but unfortunately, most of them will not. Most of them will compromise and bend, and some of the...
A lot of them, they go in, they're wealthy people, they're attorneys, they're huge business people, they're successful, they're millionaires. They're not poor folks where they're depending on a paycheck. Why would they compromise if they lose their job in 2 years or 4 years or whatever the term is? So what?
Well, first of all,
you make more money in the private sector than you would there anyway.
First of all, Paul, some of them really do believe in this internationalist dream, and that's why they're there, to push this internationalist dream and this socialist dream, because, of course, socialism is not produced, advocated by the impoverished people. It does not come from people living in poverty. Socialism comes from people with great wealth and power, because it is a wonderful theory, a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory, but it doesn't work unless somebody's in charge, and they're the ones who want to be in charge. And so many, many people, of course, people like Teddy Kennedy, they want socialism. Why? Because, of course, then the government provides for the people are subservient to the government, and he is one of the most powerful forces in our government, and there, but for the grace of God, was the President of the United States.
You know what Winston Churchill said about socialism, don't you?
What did he say?
He said, quote, "Socialism is the philosophy of failure, the creed of ignorance, and the gospel of envy."
Well,
this was in 1948.
That's a very, very wise statement, but unfortunately, we have adopted every major tenet of socialism right here in the United States, and of course, with the corporations, dominating government, you have a corporate socialist state, and that, of course, is what we used to call fascism over in Benito Mussolini's Italy.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, let's get back to the story of the book. The coming battle. Now, what else did Mr. Wahlberg tell us about what was going on at that time and what he foresaw in the future?
Okay, well, we can talk about a little bit about silver, if you like.
Let's talk about silver. That's close to something I think is a fascinating subject.
Okay, because gold was mainly minted in larger denominations, $5, $10, and $20 gold pieces. So when silver came on the scene back in
1860s.
Right. One of the biggest silver mines that was discovered was in Nevada called the Comstock Lode. Well, under free coinage in the United States, people could take their ore down to the smelter and have it minted into money. And they minted it into dollars, dimes, quarters, and so forth. Now, that became the financial liberator of the American people, because there was so much silver available that everyone could afford to have silver change in their pocket. Not everyone could afford to have $5, $10, or $20 gold pieces in their pocket, because gold was not as readily available as silver. Gold was harder to find. So that threatened the supremacy of the bankers that were on the East Coast, like Chase Bank and Hanover Bank and all that. Mr. Wahlberg names them all. So what they did is they passed a bill called to demonetize silver. In other words, make it worthless. So, and the politicians that were bought and paid for in the pocket passed this, and as they demonetized silver, that created the largest depression that has ever hit the United States. Excuse me, Mr. Wahlberg, it lasted for 1873 to 1878, for 5 years, and Mr. Wahlberg described that American tramp came on American highways, meaning homelessness. We never had any homelessness in America until after the demonetization of silver.
Well, of course, what this did was to shrink the availability of currency. In other words, if you demonetize silver, there just wasn't that much money out there in circulation. And of course, if you shrink the amount of money, while you shrink the commerce, and then there are no longer jobs and people aren't buying and selling. And that's what precipitates the depression, isn't it?
That's right. So as starvation occurred, the bankers decided, well, we got to do something to take the heat off ourselves. So what they did is they created a diversion, and they blamed the whole thing on American farmers. And they said the reason there's starvation here, because American farmers created this problem for overproducing food. There's too much food here. That's why we have starvation. So, you know, American people, they didn't have a clue of what's going on. They bought this lie, hook, line, and sinker. And we'll talk about after the break.
All right, fine. And if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to talk to Lorraine or Paul Walter, our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. The book, The Coming Battle, if you'd like to know more about it, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Fascinating book, written over 100 years ago, and yet it could have been written yesterday. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guests this evening are Rain and Paul Walter, and they have actually reproduced a book that was written by Mr. Wahlberg in 1899 called The Coming Battle, and of course he was summarizing what had happened economically up until that time, and of course he could see what lay ahead, this move towards the centralization of power in Washington, D.C., and of course this alliance between the big corporations, the big banks, and government, and of course the impoverishment of the American people. And my fear, of course, is this is eventually what is going to happen here in the United States, because so many people have excessive debt, you know, and they, oh, it's so wonderful, you know, you can refinance your house and get $100,000 out of it because it's worth so much more today than it was 5 years ago, and they can take and you can buy a new car, and you can buy a new boat, and you can take a nice trip. But what happens, of course, down the line when your house is not worth the amount of money that the loan will be? And of course, this is what's happened in Japan, where they had overinflated property values, and then suddenly property was no longer worth what it had been before. And of course, many of the previously overpriced homes or pieces of property are worth 10 cents on the dollar. And now the banks have all this property, and of course they can't sell it because nobody wants to buy the property. And of course people, the Japanese are holding their money because they lost so much of it in the stock market when their market went from 4,000 or 40,000 down to about 10,000. They lost 75% of their investment. So the Japanese are very, very loath to invest. And of course, the people are not going to be loading up on property when they've seen the property just totally contract. And of course, could that happen here in this country? Why, property is just totally overpriced here. But and I can see the day when this bubble is going to contract. And as John Templeton said, and I quoted earlier, Sir John said, you want to hold off buying your home until it's about a tenth of what it is today, and then go ahead and feel that you can, without any difficulty, go ahead and buy a property, buy a house. Richard Russell, who's an expert on the stock market, who's been following it for as long as I have, much longer and much smarter than I am, said that he anticipates that the price of gold and the stock market will intercept sometime in the not-too-distant future. In other words, gold will be up to $3,000 or $4,000 an ounce, and the stock market, which closed today at about 950 or 960, will be down around 3,000 as well. So when that happens, or if that should happen, there are going to be terrible, terrible problems here. And, of course, Mr. Wahlberg's predictions will be coming true. Well, Paul, does Mr. Wahlberg have any solution as to what needs to be done?
Yes, one of the solutions, he says, toward the end of his book, he says to get liquid, to get out of debt as fast as you can, and how can I say that? I don't have the page in front of me here, but he says that we should be very cautious about dealing with foreign countries and get involved in affairs in foreign countries, because that will bring the country down. In other words, you should keep your affairs to yourself, basically, you know,
America first.
America first, that's right, because if we get involved in other countries' business and trade and commerce, there will be a trade deficit. He predicted all this, and he's basically self-explanatory, because once you see what the problem is, you know what the solution is.
And he should also, excuse me, Dr. Montes, he also cautioned people to look very deeply into the background of the politicians that we vote for.
That's right, because he says they're scoundrels, and he talks about the bills that go to different committees, for example, where they put a good-sounding name on this bill to fool the politician. When it's like a can of worms with a picture of a tomato, or chicken soup on the outside, or a picture of a tomato or a pear, and you think, gosh, that's, you know, something good to eat there. But when you open up the can, there's nothing but a can of worms. It's the same thing, how they fool people when they put fancy names on bills to and actually the content are just the opposite. Is anything different today? The same thing is happening today.
Yes, I'll never forget the Tax Simplification Act of 1986, and what it did was make the taxes much more complicated. But, of course, and the Patriot Act, which is probably the most unpatriotic thing they ever came up with, you know, because it massively expanded police state power over the individual, and that certainly is not patriotic. So you're absolutely right. They put a name on the bill that has nothing to do with its real purpose and goal. But, you know, of course, this was written 104 years ago. And, of course, he was anticipating there was going to be a collapse a long time ago, and yet we're still going and going strong, aren't we?
Well, because the debt is still increasing on top of the debt, on top of debt, and, you know, the mountain of debt is still growing, but there's no question about it that this has got to, it's going to come to an end, whether it's going to be this year, next year, or a few years from now, it's going to have to come to an end, because you just can't, government can't print bonds, and then the Federal Reserve buys the bonds, and they give them money in exchange, and this just can't keep going and going and going in interest, and on top of interest, on top of interest. Sooner or later, this whole mountain of debt or house of cards, as you described, is going to collapse. There's no question about it. This is going to come. And I think what they're doing is they're kind of manipulating the economy here, manipulating the economy there, because they want to collapse the whole world at the same time. And I believe since the most nations, most currency, most stable currency is the dollar. And as the dollar collapses, so will the world will go with it. And I think this country is under tremendous attack from all angles, but the worst part of all is the enemy that's within our own gates, because the enemy that's at the city gate is less to be feared because they hold the banner openly and their intentions are out in the open. But the enemy within your own city, within your own country, within your own family, that pretends to be a friend and tells you they have the best your best interests at heart, is the worst enemy of all. Because that's not the enemy that you got your eye on. And that's the problem we have in this country. We have people who hide behind the Bible. We have people who hide behind the cloth. We have people who hide behind patriotism and undermining this fabric and the foundation of this wonderful country. And that is the most dangerous enemy of all. And it doesn't matter if they're doing it deliberately or they're blind, they're still undermining this country. It doesn't matter. And if you bring it to their attention, you know, they don't listen to you anyway because you're not a college graduated, somebody that they've read in a, you know, if you're just a nobody, they will never listen to you. So you have to be somebody
who's,
some influence somewhere in order to try to wake these people up, because it's very hard.
Well, Chris, an enemy you know is a lot better than an enemy you don't know, and I share your concern, Paul. And of course, you know, as we look and see what's happening worldwide, America is the one engine that is keeping the rest of the countries running. In other words, because the American people are buying a large sums of the products that are being produced in China and in Japan and Malaysia, if America stopped buying, the economies of all the rest of the world countries would at least temporarily be just collapsed. And, I mean, this is my concern, that something is going to happen here where the American people are just going to quit buying. I mean, we have the greatest buys in the world. I mean, you can get these wonderful products, you know, at just rock-bottom prices. I can, you know, compare. In fact, lots of times you can buy things cheaper here in the United States. You could buy them over in Japan or in China itself. You know, and so they're selling them here very low, just so the American people will buy. But what happens if there is a major cataclysmic event and the American people, you know, either because of debt or because of another terrorist attack or because of a plague or whatever it might be, just stop buying? And at that point, the rest of the world's economy collapses, and then we can no longer export to them, and of course our economy could contract dramatically as well. Well, our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, if you agree or you disagree, give us a call. we'd love to know what you think about what's going on. And I've had people say, well, we've heard this doom and gloom conversation in the past. Back in the 1980s, they were saying that. And of course, they said that, you know, the price of gold and silver was going to go up. And the thing is, it did go up. And then, of course, the most amazing thing is they were able to manipulate it back down again. I am constantly amazed at how the central banks, the Federal Reserve System, has been able to keep this whole house of cards together as long as they have. What are your thoughts on that, Paul?
Well, they're keeping it together because, they want to collapse it at the proper time. The Bible talks about this, that the end will come, and only the Lord knows when the end will come. Well, I think the Lord knows, but the bankers know, too, but it has to be a proper time and certain conditions and certain things have to occur. What those things are, I don't know, of course. Each country has to be in a certain condition, so it will have the maximum impact. So when they collapse it, it will be like nothing the world has ever seen. It will be the worst depression that would make the last 1929 depression look like a kindergarten picnic. And that's what I believe they're doing. I believe if one country is collapsing a little bit sooner than they should, and they prop the country up, and if one is too prosperous, they bring it down, so they're trying to manipulating all the countries until they get all the ducks in order just right, and then boom, then I think the hammer is going to fall. When that's going to be, of course, I don't know. I'm not a prophet, so I don't know, but I can see that it's coming. It's got to have to happen, because out of the ashes, the phoenix is going to rise. It's going to be called a new world order, the global government. And, you know, if you don't believe in it, then, you know, obviously you're not a very astute person. You obviously got your head in the sand like an ostrich, and you don't know what's going on. But there's no question about it. It's going to come. When, I don't think anybody knows. You can see that every year it's getting worse and worse and worse. I believe that they're waiting for another terror attack to come because people are tired of this Patriot Act right now. And, you know, they haven't found any weapons of mass destruction. They haven't found Osama. They haven't found
Saddam.
Saddam Hussein. They haven't found anything. Here we are spending $87 billion to rebuild Iraq that we bombed out of, and there was no weapons of mass destruction. So people are starting to scratch their head. So they're going to have to do something, and I believe something is coming, and it's going to be bigger than September 11th, and perhaps could come as soon as next year.
Well, you know, the thing is that we see that they've already spent $79 billion, and now they're asking for another $87 billion. You're talking about over $160 billion, and that's just the down payment on rebuilding Iraq. And, of course, why did we go in? Well, we had to go in after all. It was the only responsible thing to do. We could be attacked at any time. We couldn't allow Osama to be sitting over there with those weapons of mass destruction. He might give them to Osama bin Laden, living in a cave somewhere in Pakistan. And, of course, that would threaten the American people. So to protect the American people, we had to go into Iraq. And anybody who believes that has got to be incredibly naive. That was the rationale that was used. But that wasn't the real reason that we went in. And those of you who listen to our programs regularly know that the real reason was because the intent has always been to have our troops permanently stationed in the Middle East and to reconstruct the Muslim world so that they will go along with the New World Order and the New World Religion. That's what it's really all about.
You know what? I'm glad you said that, because I've been saying this the past 6 months, and I know that's exactly why they did it. They didn't do it for the oil. When people say, oh, well, we're in Iraq for oil. I don't believe that for one moment, because we have plenty of oil of our own. All the countries, why they'd be dumb not to sell us oil, because they get rich off of us selling us oil. Why wouldn't they sell us oil?
The international bankers
control
the oil.
Yeah, so the problem is, you see, when you're going to have Antichrist going to come in and see, an Antichrist is a Christian New World Order. It's not a Muslim New World Order. It's not an anti-Muhammad or anti-Buddha. It's Antichrist. So this means, do you think the Muslim religion is going to go part of a Christian New World Order? Not on your life. So what they have to do, they have to somehow restructure or eliminate the Muslim countries, and that's exactly why they're there. And I saw that, and I firmly, honestly believe that. And what, you know, what's going to come out of this, I don't know, and I'm kind of afraid to say more because, you know, one day I might just find my brakes didn't work going downhill, so I'm kind of afraid. So, but anyway, that's my belief why they're doing this. There's no question about it that that's why we're there.
Right, Chris, I'm not so sure it's going to be a Christian New World Order. I think this whole thing is founded in the occult, in return to paganism.
Absolutely.
But of course, what they really want to do is unite all the religions of the world, the Hindus and the Buddhists and the Muslims and the Jews and the Christians, and we'll take the good out of all these religions, because after all, they're going to say, we all worship the same God, which of course is a lie, but of course, then of course they will try to get the Christians and the Muslims and the Jews and the all the various religions, sort of like the Baha'i religion, we will all unite together. And of course, you know, the Muslim doesn't want to do that, and that's why we're over there. Of course, we have television sets in every Muslim home over in Baghdad today. Why? Because television is going to be used to change their attitude, their worldview. And then, of course, they're going to take over the educational program in the Iraqi schools. Why don't we just let them educate on their own? No. We're going to tell them what they're going to believe and what they're going to read. And we're going to, this is a gigantic social experiment.
Absolutely.
And it's going to cost hundreds of billions of dollars. And I think eventually it's going to bankrupt America.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I believe too.
And of course, you know, I think that if you stop and think that President Bush is going to have a deficit for the coming year of close to $750 billion in just 1 year. They already acknowledged we're going to have a $550 billion deficit, and I don't know whether that includes the $40 billion for the drugs that are going to go to Medicare or not, but then there will be another $300 billion that they're not going to tell you about, but that's what they steal from Social Security and Medicare, and then they replace it with an IOU. It took us 200 years, well, from 1789 till 1980, to run up a $1 trillion deficit, and George W. Bush is going to almost double that in 1 year. In other words, it was close to $1 trillion deficit for the year, that'll be 2004. And, you know, there is no instance in all history where a nation has gone massively into debt where it didn't eventually fall. Greece fell, at least in part, because of the corruption of their currency and because of the incessant wars. And that's the same thing happened with ancient Rome. And they corrupted their currency, and they had their soldiers out fighting on the borders of their empire while the Huns came and took, of course, Rome itself. But people have forgotten history, and they don't understand that when you corrupt a currency, you corrupt the people. And we carry a wonderful book called Fiat Money Inflation in France, which, of course, goes into what happened in France after 1789 when they established, reestablished society and put out a paper money. And in about 12 years, they had totally destroyed that nation, destroyed its morality, destroyed the savings of all of the people, and impoverished the middle class. And then, of course, the government, the corrupt government, was replaced with a new dictator. His name was Napoleon Bonaparte. And everybody rallied behind him because he promised, of course, you know, at least to bring stability. And he did. And wars and wars and wars.
You know, the coming battle talks about Napoleon and how he tried to unite Europe under one single currency. That's in the coming battle book.
Right.
And how he tried to, in other words, bring all the European countries together under one common currency. So this dream that they're accomplishing today, united Europe with under the euro and one common currency, it's nothing new under the sun. Napoleon tried it. They tried it before World War I with the League of Nations. Now they're doing it with the United Nations. So this dream of global domination and global one world order, it's been around since Tower of Babel, so it's nothing new, because Rome was trying to conquer the whole world and control the whole world, except they couldn't because they didn't have ships to go to Europe to United States and other continents. In fact, they didn't even know it existed. So until the technology came in back in, 1812 or 13, 1400s or
1292.
Yeah, when they created enough, where they had enough of these big sail ships that could reach different parts of the world and bring this whole thing together. This has been going on for years and years. this underground philosophy, this underground families that goes from family to family, where they call them the Illuminati or the elitist or whoever they are. It's nothing new.
Well, I think that, you know, as you say, they've been trying to create this one world order for thousands of years. In fact, that has been the secret that has been passed down from generation to generation.
That's right.
By the sages of the secret societies, that was one day be this one world order, and of course this new world religion, and it would be ruled by, of course, as you say, by the Antichrist. This has always been the goal. This was the goal when the Rosicrucians came to America in 1640. And, of course, put their emblem on the back of the Great Seal of the United States in 1782, 140 years later. And what was it? A pyramid capped by an all-seeing eye with the caption beneath, Novus Ordo Seclorum, the new social order. And, of course, the triangle that contains the all-seeing eye, the glorified eye, floats above the pyramid. And, of course, it will only symbolically settle onto the pyramid when the quest is finished. What's the quest? The New World Order, the One World Government. Every occultist understands that. If you read the writings, for instance, of Benjamin Krem in his magazine, Cher, or you read the writings of Alice Bailey, of Madame Blavatsky, they all understood, of course, the goal was a One World Order, the One World Religion. The average American doesn't understand that because they've been dumbed down. They've never been told about the ancient secret societies. They've never been told about the mystery religions of antiquity. And yet, of course, they're manifested today through the Masons and the Theosophists and the Rosicrucians and the Skull and Bone Society and, of course, the Bohemian Grove and so many of the other organizations, and their agents have infiltrated every aspect of our lives today. Well, you know, well, these are exciting times to live in, to know the Lord, aren't they, Paul and Walter?
They most certainly are. What's important is for those folks that listen to your show who don't have the Coming Battle book, I would highly recommend that they get it from you, because it would enlighten, it would bring them from 1776 and how the banking cartel put their foothold in this country, how they funded, how they were against the War of 1812 and sided with Great Britain, how every obstacle in its way to bring this country down, how they imported our cheap foreign labor from foreign countries to destroy the infrastructure of this country. This country, I tell you, I'm surprised that this country is so resilient that even withstood all this, that it withstood, and the people still don't see it. What's amazing is they still don't see, I mean, a lot of them do, of course, because they listen to shows like you and they read books and they get educated. But as long as, you know, they can go to work and get a paycheck and they can buy their six-pack of beer and they press the button and the TV comes on and there comes Laverne and Shirley, you know, they don't question anything, you see, because all the comforts of home are there. But one day, the hell is going to knock on their door. What are they going to do then? And I believe that they need to get educated, and books, history books like this one, like The Coming Battle, is very important, because Mr. Walbert didn't know there was a conspiracy. He doesn't talk about the conspiracies. He just talks about the shenanigans that went on in the 1800s and as early as 1776, and how these people that controlled the money wanted to destroy this economy, and how they created recessions and depressions and panics and everything else to rob the working people of the hard-earned money, how they inflated and contracted and expanded the money supply, everything. And it's very easily read, and it's not expensive, the book, and I guess the rest is up to you what you want to say.
Well, I think that it's well worthwhile. This is reason we carry the book. What everybody has missed, of course, is they talk about this, and people think that, of course, the bankers are motivated primarily by greed, and I'm sure that some of them are. But some of them, of course, have given themselves over to the dark side. And when you look at J.P. Morgan, what motivated him? J.P. Morgan was deeply involved with the occult. Well, what about the Rockefellers? Well, you begin looking into the background of the Rockefeller family, you realize that they, too, are involved with the occult. Stephen Rockefeller, who is involved with Gorbachev and Marie Strong now, you read his book, Science and Nature. I mean, boy, it looks like it came right out of the pit of hell. And you read this, you understand that these people do not worship the God of the Bible. They worship the other God. And, of course, we have Winthrop Rockefeller, the largest pornography collection anywhere in the world, Lawrence Rockefeller funding the writings of Barbara Marx Hubbard, and, of course, this occult underpinning of course, giving these people great wealth and great power, at least for their time here on Earth. But, of course, for eternity, and every one of us is going to live through eternity, the question is not whether we're going to live forever, but where are we going to live? And I wouldn't want to live where the Rockefellers and the Fords and the Carnegies and, of course, the Morgans and these others go. Because if you study them very carefully, you will find that they are all tied in one way or another into the occult. And this is, of course, I think what most people have missed, as they've tried to understand what is possibly going on today. Because behind, as somebody once said, behind all that foes have plotted, behind all that saints have planned, behind the schemes of men and demons is a higher hidden hand. And there really is. There's the hand of God and the hand of Satan. And right now, Satan's in control here on Earth. God will intervene one of these days. God is certainly with those who've given their lives to him and protecting them. But, one of these days he's going to bring his wrath on this country. And I tremble for my country. As Jefferson said, when I reflect that God is just and his justice will not sleep forever. Well, Paul, what are your parting thoughts? Or Lorraine, what are your parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, parting thoughts, I could say people can check out our website, newswithviews.com.
Newswithviews.com, huh?
Newswithviews. By the way, Stan, we got so big now, we're almost 7 million hits a month now.
Wonderful.
And growing. And we have an article up that I'd like to mention briefly. It's by 16-year-old Ashley Anderson. It's called America's Failing Public School System, and the World Net Daily was linking it today on the commentary page. We got close to 3 million hits on that page alone just today. And we got emails from people because, it's one thing if you write an article about a failing public system. It's another thing when a 16-year-old child writes it from her own eyes or what they've done to her and how they damaged her and what they taught her and what they didn't teach her. And we got emails from parents that said, we're so grateful for this article. We're pulling our kids out of public school. And I got tons of those emails. So we have impact on the people, and we have some wonderful writers up there waking people up. And I highly recommend that they get the book, The Coming Battle, from you and get educated about the banking system. And by the way, another thing that we talked about before, what did Mr. Walbert say that's the remedy? He said one of the remedies is to take the money away from the private cartel and in United States for issue our own money and back it by gold and silver and take it away from the and get out of debt, pay them back and pay, get liquid, pay your bills off so you're not indentured and put the bankers basically out of business and don't do any business with the foreign nations. And he warned us about this, and this is some of the solutions, because I found the page. And this is some of the solutions that Mr. Walbert offered. And, of course, we're not doing it, but we should.
All right, fine. Lorraine, do you have any parting thoughts for us?
Yes. I'd like to tell the American people that if they are looking to the government public school for education, they're getting a poor education because those in control have rewritten history. They're not even teaching American history in the public schools anymore. They're teaching world history. We need to get back to the Constitution. We need to read the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. We need to see what our rights are because they're slowly being eroded. We need to know what the Founding Fathers wanted for this country. We need to read the books that contain the information for us to learn. And there are so many books out there. I encourage people to start reading more books today.
I agree with you totally. Thank you so very much for being with us. Both of you, it's been a real pleasure. Good night, and that's newswithviews.com.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Thank you, Dr. Bunty.
Well, this is Dr. Stan saying, pray for America. Pray for revival. The book is available, The Coming Battle. And, of course, till Monday, may the Lord be with you.